20-4051, Elena Harrison v. Montgomery County, Ohio. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes to be shared by plaintiff and Amicus Pacific Legal Foundation. 15 minutes for the defendant, 20 minutes for interested party, Ohio Attorney General. We'll start with Ms. White for the appellant.
Good morning. Emily White representing appellant Elena Harrison. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. May it please the court, Elena Harrison owned a home in Dayton, Ohio that was worth more than she owed in property taxes. And with the goal of economic redevelopment and using a relatively recent statutory process, Montgomery County transferred her property to the Montgomery County Land Bank. No taxes were collected and no sale of the property occurred. And in fact, the county expressly decided to forego the collection of all delinquent taxes when it transferred the property to the land bank, and it permanently waived its right to collect those amounts. So at the conclusion of the process, my client was deprived of the surplus equity in her property without just compensation.
In this way, Ms.
Let me ask you just a question about that. I'm not sure this changes any analysis, but it's a practical question. If instead your client went to a forced sale, the sheriff's sale or whatever you call it in Ohio, and she got less than the taxes, she would then owe the difference, would she not?
No, she would not. Under all of Ohio's tax foreclosure schemes, the property taxes run with the land. So there's no possibility of a personal judgment. It's an in rem proceeding.
Okay, so, but there's no guarantee she would get over the tax, that anybody would bid over the taxes.
Not necessarily, but the standard for just compensation is that it be the value of the property. And so while a sheriff's sale is not a perfect vehicle to extract the maximum value of the property, it is an acceptable vehicle under due process.
Let me ask you this. Where would your client be if we sent it back to the sheriff's sale and she got less than the taxes? Where would your whole claim be then?
Well, Your Honor, the matter of the disposition of the property actually is res judicata, unlike the question of just compensation. So this is not a scenario where we could unring a bell and undo the prior transaction. That has been finally decided, and the deed transfer is final. There is no possibility at this point of undoing that transaction and selling the property. However, the Supreme Court tells us in Nick that a property owner has an actionable Fifth Amendment taking.
Counsel, I definitely want to get to Nick. It's very powerful for your side, but I just want to clear away a little bit of underbrush. Selling the property has these administrative costs. The administrative costs take away quite a bit of the equity. I think not all of it. I think there might maybe still be $800 left of equity for Ms. Harrison. But if we're in takings land, so leave res judicata and Nick to the side, isn't it fair for the state and county, if they do have to provide compensation, to account for those administrative costs?
Yes, and we're not disputing those. Those, once again, are also res judicata. They are part of the collection costs. They are properly imposed, and we're not.
So the equity that you're seeking is really, it's about $800, isn't it?
Yes, it's the amount that exceeds all of the impositions and the court costs. In this case, it happens to exceed $800, but in many cases, it will be much more.
So this case is all about $890. Is that what we're saying?
Well, it is a putative class action, Judge. So for this particular client, it may in fact be $800, which is still a property interest that is protected. Sure. But for other folks, it could be significantly larger. In this case,
or significant less.
If this process is utilized in a case where there is no surplus equity, then there is no taking in that scenario. And that's actually the scenario that the legislature envisioned when it created this process. And in fact, it's silent on what happens in the event that there is surplus equity. In this case, a claim.
Can you just tease out what you just said? Are you making the point the legislature thought the land banks would only be used in settings where there was no excess property?
Well, without getting too deep into legislative history, yes, that was in fact the problem that this statute was intended to solve, was the problem where the minimum bid at a tax foreclosure sale had to be the amount of the imposition. So if the property were offered for sale and nobody purchased it at that price, then it would go for another sale, another delay, and then it would eventually sell for no minimum bid. And so this procedure was presented as an option to not have to do that sale at all. But by doing so, now we've opened up a universe of properties where surplus equity is taken for economic redevelopment without just compensation.
And all right, so I cut you off when you were getting to Nick. So let me ask you a question about Nick to make sure I understand. So the way Nick works is it says you can go to federal court once the taking occurs. You don't have to wait for the state procedures for compensation. It's at the time of the taking. And so you still need a final order that is a taking. When did that occur here? How should that work now? How should this system work after Nick?
Sure. It's actually very clear. Nick is whenever in a physical takings case, it's when the physical taking is completed and when the property right is extinguished. In this case, that the equity of redemption, which is that last little grasp of property interest, expires 28 days after journalization of the Board of Revision's decision. The appeal deadline, by contrast, is 14 days. So the extinguishment of the property interest and the physical taking occurs 14 days after the appeal deadline expired, which, once again, the appeal only would concern the amount and the validity and the disposition of the property. It is silent as to the surplus equity that is the basis of this takings claim. That has not and could not have been litigated in the prior proceeding for a number of reasons. I would like to address it could not have been litigated because there was no appeal to be made of any matter that the Board of Revision has decided. For the purpose of this case, my client accepts the finality and does not seek to disturb the Board of Revision's decision. And where there is no appeal to be raised, there is no 1983 action to be joined with that appeal. So this case is factually distinguishable from both Carroll and Moore, where my client is not seeking to raise the takings claim defensively as a shield to prevent a taking from occurring. She's accepting the fact of the taking and seeking just compensation for her surplus equity. I see that I've run out of time.
So tell me, just to help me, I'm fearful there's a little ignorance in this question, so don't be ashamed to tell me or afraid to tell me I'm missing something obvious. What do you want now? Like, let's say you're right. It's not res judicata. Let's say we agree with you when Nick allows the claim. And Nick, of course, had not been decided when this happened. What's the relief you want? Do you want something that says you can, you know, you federal district court now has to decide it? Is that the key?
Yes, it's not res judicata, although collateral estoppel may actually have decided some matters in this case, for instance, the validity and amount of the impositions. But what we want here is just compensation. That would be the value of the surplus equity.
Now, if let's say we agree roughly on when the final order that constitutes a taking occurs, if that in the future, that would become the fork in the road. You don't go to federal district court at that point and you decide to raise whether you bring federal claims or not, you if you stick in the state court, then res judicata could apply whether you brought the federal claim or not. Is that correct if you take that fork in the road?
Well, let me suggest the fork also depends on the nature of the takings claim that is brought. In many cases, especially regulatory takings, which are the bulk of the case law that's cited here, you're attempting to stop the thing that was adjudicated or undo a prior adjudication by raising the constitutional claims defensively. Please don't take my property at all. But in this case, we're accepting and not disturbing that finding. And so where it's a just compensation claim, it's quite simple. Nick says you have the right to go to court, to federal court, and raise a 1983 action when the taking is completed. And that is when the property is actually taken. And in this
but I'm
case,
just, I just want to make sure that fork in the road, I agree that this is distinct from regulatory takings. If you choose to stay in state court, you could go to state court and raise a 1983 federal claim as well as the state takings claim.
Absolutely.
That would all be res judicata if you took that fork in the road.
If you took that fork in the road, and there are also procedural hurdles, because if you wanted to raise that claim affirmatively under Ohio state statutory procedure law, you would have to bring an administrative appeal, commence a separate 1983 action, and join them under Civil Rule 42 as a consolidated matter, and then proceed that way. But the court would still be facing, you know, essentially appellate review of the administrative decision with a limited record, and then have a separate 1983 action where you've got a summons and complaint and a different standard of review, different evidence. But also, I'll say you don't have to go that far for Sixth Circuit case law that says that when the action is complete, there are temporal roadblocks and markers along the road that tell us when those are. Checkers gives us an example of when
I think we've got the point, and I think you've got some rebuttal, correct?
Great.
Okay. Great. All right. Well, you've got your full rebuttal, and let's hear from whomever's next. Looks like we've got four folks today.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Christina Martin for Amicus Pacific Legal Foundation. May it please the court. I want to briefly answer that question about whether this case matters, even though there's only potentially as little as $800 at stake. And the answer is yes. Again, this is a putative class action, and many property owners lose substantially more, including former Pacific Legal Foundation client Elliot Feltner, who lost $80,000 in equity. And we know that this is happening to many other property owners. So the question here is not how much compensation would be due. That's a matter of fact that's decided after you decide whether there's a taking. And here we know there's a taking because the common law traditionally protects a delinquent property owner's interest in their surplus value of their property. And at common law, that meant the property had to be sold to the highest bidder, the cost paid, the taxes paid, and any remaining money had to be returned. When the tax collector would fail to enforce that, the property owner could bring an action in trespass, forfeiture, and now in undertaking. And that right was recognized.
You know, what's your answer to the point, you know, if we had the legislature here, they might say something along the lines of, you know, we tried this foreclosure approach. You have no idea the variation in properties. You have no idea the abandoned homes problem we face. And the beauty of the land bank approach is it's just a lot quicker. It's true. It may be at the expense of property owners. Is there a way to do the land bank approach that facilitates the efficiency but still takes care of the property owner and any equity they have? And is there some simple solution here?
Sure. So they could evaluate what just compensation would be at the time of the taking and then pay what just compensation would be. And that would be a matter of fact. Eminent domain is used regularly in the state of Ohio. They could use that same procedure. Alternatively, the land bank could participate in the auction, and they could bid at auction, provided the auction is done publicly and in a fair manner to avoid fraud or self-dealing. So certainly the land bank can continue to operate and continue to do, you know, address blight and the issues that the legislature might have had in mind, according to the county. But what they can't do is take property that's worth more than what the government's owed and fail to pay just compensation for that surplus value and fail to abide by the traditional requirement that is normally recognized in Ohio that requires the sale of property to the highest bidder, the payment of debts, and the return of the surplus proceeds. And
I'll just make
that traditional...
Are you seeking the same relief that Ms. White is?
There's
some difference in what you suggest.
No, Your Honor, we would like to see that the government pay just compensation whenever it's taking property that's worth more than what it is entitled to.
Okay, that's fine.
So the right at issue here was recognized at common law, and briefly I want to address an argument raised by the Attorney General that he cites two examples, including the tax context, and suggest that those somehow justify what Ohio is doing here. Both examples are completely distinguishable. The first one has to do with liquor. And in that case, the allegation was that there was tax fraud. And tax fraud is, of course, a criminal activity. And so that puts this sort of case squarely under the situation. And in cases like Venice, where the property is tainted with criminal activities, and the property here is not. In Ms. Harrison's case, there is no allegation of criminal activity. It's neither the fruit nor the instrumentality of crime. And the other case cited by the county is by the Attorney General, is Wilds Lessee. And it's really important to understand that was decided by the Virginia Supreme Court, and it was a dispute about who owned the land. It was not about whether there was just compensation. A decade later, the same court, the same state Supreme Court, actually recognized that when government takes more than it's owed, it would violate due process of law, and it would violate the principle that government pay just compensation. And that's the case of Martin versus Sloan, and I cited that in the amicus.
Council, one real quick question. What if they actually don't know who owns the land? What if it's truly abandoned? You really can't find the owner. They're deceased. No one wants anything to do with it. In that sense, in that setting, would this approach work?
So the standard in Ohio for abandoned property is that there's an actual intent to abandon. And if they can satisfy that, then they could treat this as abandoned property. But the statute here doesn't even attempt to apply the common law principle.
It's kind of like in a sheet system, and I just wanted to see if that was comparable.
Sure, and they could probably also use unclaimed property statute to dispose of any surplus funds.
All right, thank you very, very much. Who's next?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Stephen Funk of the law firm of Retzel and Andrews on behalf of the appellee, Montgomery County. Before I address the race judicata arguments, I first want to begin by addressing some of these merits arguments that have been discussed by appellant's counsel and amicus counsel. There is really no legal basis for their takings claim. This is a statutory remedy for the failure to pay taxes, and it was created by the General Assembly specifically to address the unique problems that were being posed by abandoned tax delinquent lands in tax foreclosure proceedings. And by definition, it can only be imposed if there's a failure to pay taxes. In other words, but for the failure to pay taxes, there would be no tax foreclosure proceeding. There would be no potential transfer. So it's an integral
You're arguing the merits, and that's fine, but keep in mind that the plaintiff did not get to argue the merits because you argued they don't get to. And after Nick, you need to come to grips with that. That is a very serious problem in this case.
Well, Your Honor, on Nick, I think you explained, I think, Nick correctly, that what Nick did not do is it did not change the finality basis for ripeness. So in other words, the rightness standard that has long applied to take the claim continues to apply. And that standard looks better.
Tell me if I'm being unfair in characterizing your position, and I guess this question goes to the state as well. As I understand it, you would say the claim preclusion could have brought part of that doctrine was triggered at two instances in this case. At the very outset, they could have gone to state court, raised federal and state claims. And then there's this off ramp pretty early in the proceeding when you can remove the whole thing to Court of Common Pleas. Court of Common Pleas can handle state and federal claims. And the reason res judicata applies because they had these two options. They didn't invoke them, didn't bring their federal takings claim at that point. And the thing that I think is very tricky about that position is that Nick, it does overrule Williamson County and most of San Remo, but it still leaves in place. This was a very important part of Nick. It still leaves in place a final state order of a taking. They don't require you to determine the compensation, but it does say you've got to establish a taking. And at those two stages in the state process, you don't have a taking. You just don't have a taking at that point. And the reason you don't have a taking is you don't know yet whether they're going to go the land bank or the foreclosure route. And what you're doing with your position, respectfully, is recapturing the Williamson County San Remo trap, because by the time they have their order, which is the taking, they have res judicata. And that just seems really strange.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's strange at all. I could actually, the judicial review scheme established by the General Assembly, I think.
Okay, not strange, but violates NIC.
Okay. I don't think it does violate NIC, because what NIC does reaffirm is that the finality, when the administrative agency applies the regulations or statutes at issue to the property, that creates a right claim. And in this case, it was the Board of Revision who ordered a transfer under Revised Code 323.78 when it issued its final order. And so what happens then at that point, once the board issues that order, it is a final decision, and it is right for review. And then there's an opportunity for judicial review pursuant to Revised Code 323.79. And part of that is to ensure, the General Assembly wanted to ensure that they made that statute very, very broad to ensure that any and all claims that were, quote, pertinent to the property. And that's the thing that's pertinent to the property.
Let me just, I try to do this without invoking statutory sections. Just tell us when the federal takings claim is ripe after NIC. In other words, you know you're using the land bank approach. When does that happen? Does it happen at the outset? That's not ripe, right?
Well, I would say that the actual application of the transfer at that point, the outset, there's an indication that may occur. So a property owner is put on notice.
The May makes it not ripe. So the first option doesn't work.
Well,
second option, that off ramp. Are you saying that first off ramp, it's ripe at that point?
At the point in which the board issues there, it's a final order under the statute. The board issues an order that orders the foreclosure and transfer of the property under 323.78.
But at that point, they might still go the foreclosure route. So it's not ripe.
No, it's already a final order of foreclosure and transfer.
I might be missing something, but as I understand it, at that stage, that order still gives the county the option of foreclosure through sale, where they get their equity back, or land bank. Am I wrong about that?
No, Your Honor, you are wrong about that. So you actually read the final order for this case, the record. If you look at that order, it's very detailed, and it's provided not only for the foreclosure, also for the direct transfer of the property. So at that point, that's the final order under the statute that is subject to appeal, and any and all issues that are going to be raised, including issues that are raised for the first time on appeal, can be raised. So there's no question.
I just want to make sure you understand what I'm saying, because you haven't explained the answer to this yet. Okay. I thought at that point, the reason it's not a final taking is that there's still the possibility, if they go the foreclosure route, they'll get the excess equity, because that route doesn't have a taking problem to it. It's the land bank route that has the taking problem to it. And I think what you're saying is, Judge, it's still a final order. And I'm saying the reason it's not ripe is because you don't know which path they're taking at that point.
Yeah, no, Your Honor, you do know exactly what path they're taking at that point. So I think
you cannot do a foreclosure at that point, sell the property and give them the excess equity at that point.
That's correct, Your Honor. So very clear that the decision is made at that point by the Board of Revision, and that's the final order. They don't that order then provided for the direct transfer. So at that point, they've elected that remedy.
And that's the stage where you can go to the Court of Common Pleas, correct?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
So there's no question that the statute...
Let's say you're right. Why wouldn't we in this case... I don't think you're right, but let's say you're right. Why wouldn't we in this case say that, given that NIC had not come out yet, that they ought to get the chance to go to federal court now, because NIC comes out after the opportunity you're talking about?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the General Assembly here came up with a judicial review scheme in which they were trying to ensure the efficient and timely resolution of all issues relating to these tax delinquents.
No. Answer the question I asked. The question I asked is, they didn't know Nick would come out a year later. Why isn't it appropriate, since the case is still pending, your case, this case is still pending, let them now go to federal court, because they didn't, the Williamson County trap was removed by Nick, so let them avoid the trap. Why isn't that fair?
Because I don't think Nick ultimately changes the fact that this was a final order and appealable at that moment, and that they could have 1983 claims. They could have brought their takings claims in connection with that.
Not correct. At that point, they had to stick with not just the taking problem, exhausting the effort to obtain compensation.
Right. I understand, Your Honor. But in this situation, the General Assembly was just seeking to ensure that all claims are brought in connection with the appeal. So there is certainly the ability to bring takings claims in connection with whatever state laws are provided for in state court. And that's the whole point, is bring all your claims in one proceeding so that we can get them resolved and timely and expeditiously. So that it can't be years later where, after the property has already been disposed of, people are now bringing new claims. And that's one interesting fact I wanted to point out to Your Honor, is that in this particular case, their argument about the transfer 14 days had not, the transfer had already occurred before the 14 days.
I just want to clarify one last thing. I want to make sure I understand the county's position. You think that Ms. Harrison knew at this fork in the road, this off ramp we just talked about, she knew she could go to federal court and a federal court would have taken that claim in 2018. Is that your position?
No, that's not my position. No, okay. Her remedy would be
a federal court in 2018 would have said Williamson County does not allow that, correct?
That's right. My position, Your Honor, just so we're clear, is that that she needed to follow the judicial review scheme established by the General Assembly, which provided for a right to bring claims in state court.
I don't understand your position. It really doesn't make any sense to me. You admit he couldn't bring a 1983 action in federal court in 2018 at this stage in the case when you say it was final because it was prohibited by Williamson County. Nick overrules Williamson County. This case is still pending, and you're saying she can't use Nick now.
Your Honor, I'm making the same argument that was made in Moore, the recent case that we cited in our 28J letter, and the Carroll versus City of Cleveland. In all of those cases, the forum in which they could bring their 1983 claims was in state court. That they bring their claims in state court, that's what creates the res judicata effect.
Are those post Nick decisions?
No, those are pre Nick decisions.
Okay, so
Moore is post Nick, but Nick Carroll is pre Nick, and so in the res judicata effect arises from the failure to bring the claims in the context of state court remedies that are being provided under the judicial review scheme. And so the argument that's being made is really the same argument that was made in Carroll, which is pre-Nick, which is that upon a final order, you can bring any and all claims, including takings claims, in state court pursuant to the judicial review scheme established by the Ohio General Assembly. And that's the res judicata effect here. Not the failure to file a separate action in federal court. It's the failure to bring all your claims in context of the judicial review provided of the state court action. And what Carroll and Moore clearly say is that res judicata applies to administrative work, and that whereas here you have a statutory judicial review scheme that provides the opportunity to bring any and all claims relating to that administrative order via that state judicial review scheme, that would have a res judicata effect if you failed to exercise this remedy. But I do want to make the point that factually, in this case, we do have a situation where the property was actually transferred within the 14 days. So I just want to make that point that even under their own argument, it would still not apply.
Mr. Funk, I don't understand what you just said. What you're saying, even under their view, of when the order's final? Go ahead. What were you trying to say?
I was just going to say that the property in this case actually transferred to the land bank within the 14 days of the board's final order.
Okay, so explain what that...
The board's final order was issued, and then within 14 days, the sheriff's deed was recorded, the transfer of the title.
And the import of that point is?
I think it's just under their own art. They're saying that the title is transferred is the key moment of when it's final. My position is that it's final when the board's order is issued. In other words, they're saying the taking doesn't occur until the title transfer.
Was this suit filed before the Nick case came down?
No, it was not.
It's after. Okay.
Yeah. But my view on this, Your Honor, is that Nick did not change anything regarding res judicata law and how it should be applied to this case. The res judicata effect arises from the fact that the administrative order that subject to judicial review pursuant to Ohio's judicial review scheme. And what Carroll says and all the cases that cite, and what Moore says, is that if you fail to exhaust those remedies, if you fail to seek and bring in all your claims in state court pursuant to the judicial review scheme provided, that provides a res judicata effect. You cannot then file another action.
I have one last question for you. Let's say that we don't think the order that constitutes the taking in the administrative process. Let's say I disagree with you about when that is, that I think it's when they think it is, just hypothetically, okay? If that's true, then would you concede that they can bring this action? Because if they're right about that, that means we really are back to Williamson County, right? Because you're going to say they missed their chance earlier, but it wasn't final earlier, so they're back to the trap problem. Wouldn't you agree that if they're right about when finality occurs, that if you deploy claim preclusion the way you're deploying it, you really are back to the Williamson County San Remo trap?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor, because Williamson is dealing with ripeness for federal court claim. In this situation, we have ripeness based upon when they can file their action in judicial review in state court. So the res judicata effect arises from the state court proceedings and the state opportunity for just review in state court. And so the Williamson County, in my mind, has no impact on their ability to bring their claims in state court pursuant to the just review scheme. If I could just very briefly address the fact that I do think that the Tax Injunction Act in comedy applies to this case, and that's an issue that we raise as a threshold issue. And the reason for that is that this is really a challenge to the constitutionality of the statutory remedy provided by the General Assembly.
It seems very counterintuitive to say the Tax Injunction Act applies to something that isn't about taxes.
That's our point. This is exactly about taxes. This is a remedy for the failure to pay taxes. It's part of Ohio's tax collection statute. And this is essentially challenging the constitutionality of a remedy that the General Assembly adopted for the collection of taxes. And essentially, you know, it's no different than forfeiture. The Supreme Court in direct marketing specifically held that forfeiture is, if you look at it, is whether or not look at all the police value for the failure to pay taxes. Forfeiture is no different than transfer. In both situations, the state is collecting the property as a remedy for the failure to pay taxes.
What about the decision in Freed?
And Freed involves a post-election remedy dealing with the failure to refund the surplus proceeds after the tax is paid. In this case, that's not what we're talking about. They're challenging a remedy that's part of the tax foreclosure proceeding. The remedy established for the tax
Why wouldn't this be after the taxes are paid? Isn't that the whole point? They're not asking not to pay taxes, they're asking for after the tax bill has been paid, after the costs of collection have been paid, we want the excess.
Yeah, no, that's not what this is dealing with. This is dealing with a remedy established for the payment, this is a remedy for the failure to pay tax. So it's part of the tax foreclosure proceeding. And they're basically, it's no different than a forfeiture remedy. They're challenging a remedy that the General Assembly has created for the forfeiture tax.
I think, Mr. Funk, we've got your argument. Thanks for answering our questions. It's a really tricky case. So we'll hear from the state.
Thank you, Judge Sutton, Judge Sir Heinrich, Judge Seiler. May it please the court. Thank you, first of all, for the invitation to participate. I'll do my best to help the court untangle this case. Nick has taken center stage, I think, so far in the questioning, so I want to begin there. And the bottom line of Nick, if you look at the bottom of the chief's opinion, I think is to restore the Fifth Amendment to an equal status to other aspects of the Bill of Rights, or say the 14th Amendment. So if you think about analogies to other aspects of the Bill of Rights that you might want to litigate, say that you have a challenge to a liquor permit or some other licensing, you're going to bring a substantive due process or First Amendment challenge to that. If you're the first mover, you, of course, have the option to go to federal court. That's true now of the Takings Clause and the First Amendment. If you find yourself in a defensive posture, say it's a revocation of your license, you would have to bring the First Amendment defense there. You would have to interpose it as a reason not to revoke the license or not face the fine or what have you. So in that way, Nick is putting the Fifth Amendment, that component of the Fifth Amendment, on the same plane with other aspects of the Bill of Rights.
So when they obviously didn't know about Nick during the proceedings, so we'll circle back to that equity impediment problem. But let's just say now we know Nick's there. How should this work going forward? I get the distinction between, you don't bring a takings claim without a taking. So you have to have some action by the county or the government. How should it work? When is it ripe to bring a Nick claim? And if you don't bring it then, when is it appropriate to apply claim preclusion?
Well, I guess when it might be ripe, if you're talking about the first mover problem, it might be, that would be an Article 3 question. So maybe that you are someone who owns multiple pieces of property and they're facing this kind of process.
Well, I mean, maybe let's try to put first mover to the side. I'm not sure it's helping me much. Sort of this. We have a system in place for foreclosure. The state has added the option of the land bank as another approach to dealing with, dilapidated, abandoned land. I'm just trying to figure out, if Nick had been in place and Ms. Harrison had Ms. White as her lawyer, when could she have brought the takings claim? Just rewind the history. When could she have brought it?
Well, she could have raised a takings argument. Her answer was, and the answer in this foreclosure case was, I want to keep the house. That's a takings argument of, you can't go through this process without, I want to block this process because going through with it means taking property, because we know from the face of the statute that there is at least the auditor's number minus all the costs of this, some of that money is not going to come back to you. You know at the beginning of this foreclosure process that you face that possibility.
Okay, so that's option A. That one does not seem to be ripe for a federal takings claim, because it's not yet clear whether the county is going to use the foreclosure route allows the taxpayer to get the excess. That eliminates the takings problem. So at the outset, I don't understand why the takings claim is right, because you don't know if they're going foreclosure or land bank.
Well, just like any time you...
What am I missing?
Well, let me make two points, Your Honor. Anytime you're going to use the Constitution to avoid an outcome, like in my analogy to the liquor license, it is something you raise about what might happen if this process plays out. But even if you think that you need to wait until foreclosure, the foreclosure process is going to go the land bank route, remember, you have the administrative appeal, and you get to common pleas court, you can raise any issue. It is a review de novo. It is the most open-ended administrative process possible.
So I think, just to stop there, I think that's ground. I think that's what both lawyers on the other side say is the time when you bring the Nick claim. When it's time for the administrative appeal, at that point you can bring state and federal claims in the state process, or you could opt out and bring your federal takings claim in federal district court. That makes sense to me. That seems like the final order taking that applies. That seems fair.
I will say, so you could opt out then. That still leaves res judicata in place here because Ms. Harrison did not take the administrative appeal. She did not take advantage of the very unique provision in the statute that lets you move right past the administrative
process. Wait. You obviously know the next question. At the time she had that option, Nick hadn't been decided. Williamson County and San Remo would have prohibited her from going to federal court at that point. You can't say res judicata applies to an option you didn't have.
Well, they may have prohibited her from going to federal court, but my point, to draw the analogy again back to the First Amendment, is if when you're in a defensive posture in state court, you don't get to remove yourself and go over and launch other litigation in federal court. You face res judicata if you don't raise the federal claim there. It's not a matter of getting to federal court. It's about raising the federal issue. And that is what, and that's what the very recent decision in Hiram Township said. That's a post-Nick decision. That's not a takings case. But just like other aspects of the Bill of Rights, that Ms. Harrison could have raised the takings arguments in this administrative appeal. And she didn't do that. And this is ultimately the preclusive effect is you're ultimately a state law question. One case that we pointed you to in the letter brief is an Ohio Supreme Court case, Kearns versus Simmers, as very similar to what's going on here, although they thought of it in terms of the standards for mandamus under state law. What happened there was a property owner based an administrative decision that they thought they were taking. They didn't take the administrative appeal. They later launched a process that was only aimed at getting compensation. In Ohio, if the relevant government actors aren't taking steps, you have to mandamus them. And when Mr. Kearns tried to mandamus them, the Ohio Supreme Court said, you're out of luck. This is a part of the package you should have raised in the administrative appeal to either block the taking or to get compensation if it went forward.
The reason this argument seems strange to me is you say we should hold it against her at the time they could have done the administrative appeal. You could have raised a federal claim then, and we should hold that against her even though Nick hadn't been decided. Let's just put that to the side for a second. Remember Mr. Funk's argument. Mr. Funk's argument is you should raise the federal claim either at the outset or at that first option to go to Court of Common Pleas. If that's true, you don't have the option of the federal claim then, right? I mean, he said you got to bring the claim when you have that choice. And that's like a double trap, right? So why isn't that a problem, that theory?
I don't think it is a trap. And again, this is our view that Nick puts the Fifth Amendment in the same plane as other constitutional rights. You don't get the choice of forum when you're in a defensive posture where you have the opportunity to raise a federal claim. I don't think Williamson County would have prevented in 2018 someone raising a Fifth Amendment argument in the state administrative proceeding or a common pleas or anywhere along the chain.
The whole point was that it required it. And then it said, if that's what you did or didn't do, San Remo made it all claim preclusion, i.e. the only way you ever get to federal court in a taking setting is in a cert petition to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's exactly the system they blew up.
They did, Your Honor. But again, that what Williamson County is about, when you before there's any litigation, you're not in a defensive posture. Can you be forced to start your own state court litigation? That's not what's going on here. Just like my example of the liquor licensee, when you're in a defensive posture, I don't think Williamson County would have prevented in 2018 Ms. Harrison or others like her from raising.
I think we're having a miscommunication or misunderstanding or disagreement about the meaning of Nick. Nick left in place part of Williamson County and San Remo. In order to avoid the injunction problem, they said your opportunity to bring a 1983 federal takings claim in federal district court only was triggered with a final order that mounts to a taking. So you're right in the sense that Williamson County, you couldn't have done this either way. You still have to have this order of a taking. That's when your opportunity to go to federal court happens. And under the Ohio system, you don't get the final order till you've missed your chance to go to state court.
Well, again, I think there's a difference between the offensive and defensive posture. So Nick blows up the you must start state court litigation. I don't read Williamson County and Nick, the whole trilogy of Williamson County.
No, it doesn't blow up state court. Offensive or defensive, you have to start in state court. That's the part it preserves. It says everything is about state court until there's a final order that establishes the taking. Then, without worrying about compensation procedures, then you can go to federal district court, bring your 1983 federal takings claim. Nick leaves in place a good part of Williamson County and even San Remo.
Fair enough. And that's why I try to describe them as a trilogy, that all three of those do retain some vitality. But again, when you're in litigation, you're in this foreclosure proceeding, you must raise the Fifth Amendment. I don't view that as something that Williamson County would have blocked even before Nick. This is an argument you must raise. You know, you have an argument, you say, I mean, think about the, just as a practical matter of why this matters is, you know, you hear Ms. Harrison say, well, we accept some aspects of this are res judicata, but now we just want a determination of what this land is worth. But you know, res judicata is not a doctrine of ambush. These government entities, if they had to go through the paces of evaluating what this land is worth, they may not want to have this property to begin with.
I have to challenge the use of the word ambush, given that there is not a court in the country that would have allowed them to go to federal court at any stage of this. How is that ambush? I mean, Nick is what overruled that whole regime. That's not ambush. I mean, it's ambush to say you missed an opportunity no one thought you had. That would be ambush.
I'll dial back ambush to selective use of res judicata then, I guess. So what that means is that the local governments here never had the option to say, we don't want this land at all because we don't want to go through the compensation procedure. Knowing whether Ms. Harrison was going to object to the procedure because it was a violation of the Fifth Amendment if there wasn't compensation for this slice of surplus that may have been there, something that should have been raised at the very latest at the time of the administrative appeal when you got to Ohio Common Pleas Court. She didn't take advantage of that, just like the litigants in, you know, Kearns versus Simmers in the Ohio Supreme Court decision. And so
is that a post-Nick case?
It is, I believe, no, it is not a post-Nick case.
What's a post-Nick case that says res judicata when there was no opportunity at the time to go to federal court?
Well, I'm not aware of one of those, Your Honor, but I guess where I think we're hung up is this, does there have to be an opportunity to get off the state litigation track and go to federal court at the moment of the final order? And our view is that even before Nick, you know, Williamson County would not have barred a Fifth Amendment claim, argument, whatever you want to characterize it as, in this process, at the administrative appeal out of the administrative process, the Board of Review, into the Common Pleas Court. And so at that moment, well, that's where res judicata is. Now we've spent, I don't want to move away from Nick if there's more to talk about there, but I just want to briefly touch on, since Your Honors did.
So how about this? Maybe I'm just misremembering it, but I don't know if it's Calder versus Bull, but this kind of basic principle of American law, the government cannot take property from A and give it to B. Would that not be exactly what the land bank does?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, since we're talking about the Fifth Amendment here and not, you know, the state constitution, the beginning of Justice Stevens' opinion in Kelo talks about just doing that where property was transferred to railroads and so forth.
Kelo has compensation. What I've just described is, I thought, what Calder versus Bull says. You can't take property from A and give it to B. Hilo involves at least giving them some compensation. Here, there's no compensation.
Well, there's no compensation because, so if we'll move over to the takings part of the argument here, because there is, you have a combination of things going on here, tax delinquency and abandonment. And that's why we pointed you in the letter brief to several things that also involve, for example, the recording statutes involve transfer of property from one to the other when it's been abandoned. So do the systems like in Texaco versus Short, where you had to reaffirm your interest in this real property interest, or United States versus Locke. All of those, by not taking affirmative action to avoid abandonment, there was a transfer of a real property interest. And so those things, along with, if you want to go way, way back to what is the meaning of property even before the founding, we pointed you to, in the brief, to several colonial era statutes that have this same built-in principle. And this is sort of a Lucas background principles of law point, that what does it mean to have property, and abandonment is an aspect of that. And those statutes had a broader sense of abandonment than the kind of abandonment my friends were talking about when talking about abandoning personal property and so forth. They had a component to them that involved making some use of the land. So abandonment is certainly something that is a background principle. And if we're going to get past the res judicata problem, that is a way that we would suggest analyzing the takings. I know I've somewhat took us away from Nick, and I want to make sure I come back to that if there's more to talk about. But I guess the bottom line is, I guess I'm not sure.
Tell me, I've asked this question, Mr. Funk. I mean, I thought res judicata law, I just thought it was a very basic principle. You're not expected to raise a claim if there was an impediment in the law to bringing the claim. And I think you think there was no impediment during this process because they could have raised their federal claims, right? That's how I think both you and Mr. Funk are perceiving this, and why you don't think there's any unfairness here. And that seems strange to me, because I thought the whole point of Nick was to get rid of this feature of Williamson County that denied you a federal court venue for a 1983 takings claim. And so it's very funny to me that they didn't know about Nick. They didn't have that option then. And you're saying, don't worry about it. You still get your state court forum to litigate your federal claim. Traditional res judicata principles apply. That just seems really funny to me. And it's not going to solve many problems, for what it's worth. I mean, this is an $800 case, one person. We now know how this works. So it's just very funny that we wouldn't let her claim proceed in federal court. That's just seems strange to me.
Well, to us, the oddity, there isn't the oddity, because we don't view Williamson County as having been a barrier even in 2018. And I think it goes back to the offensive defensive point about other constitutional claims. You don't have the ability, even if you had the ability to start your First Amendment challenge to, say, the licensing scheme, if you had the ability to start that in federal court, if you could satisfy Article 3, that doesn't mean you get to off-ramp to federal court once a proceeding has been initiated against you. I think that is the analogy here as to why whatever Nick did change about the world, it didn't change that feature, that you had the opportunity at that point, at the latest at least, when you got to Ohio Common Pleas Court. And that's where this court's precedence about being able to bring something alongside the administrative appeal in 1983 do come into play. I mean,
it gave you a right to go to Court of Common Pleas. It didn't give you a right to go to federal district court. And plenty of people think state courts and federal courts are equal, or maybe the state courts are even better. But there are a few others that think there's something sacred about a federal court forum with a federal claim.
Since we're in a federal court, I'll say maybe there is something special about federal courts, but we don't think that the law before and after Nick was not that you always got to go to federal court. If you find yourself in a position where you could and should have raised as a defensive matter some aspect of the Constitution, First Amendment, 14th, 5th, then you should have done that before or after Nick versus Township of Scott. I'm sorry, I thought this was a question from one of the other panels on the gallery view here. Your Honors, we think that this court's precedent about what Ohio law is, it lines up with Kearns versus Simmers, and that is the straightest line to resolving this case. And if you do get to the takings question, then we think the different analogies here to adverse possession or recording statutes or the forfeiture statute in Nelson versus the City of New York, as well as the other cases, I'll rely on those in the brief, as I know I've used up quite a bit of time here. Those show, they all point in the same direction as to why there is not a Fifth Amendment problem here. If there are any other questions, I'll yield what little time is left. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the shot. Do you have some more time?
Am I up yet?
I think you're the last person. I assume this is rebuttal.
I'd reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, go for it.
All right, if I may, I have three quick points to raise. And the first one, I hope Judge Sutton will address some of your concerns about the nature of the takings claim. I think it's instructive to look at, there are really two different ways a takings claim can be raised, and it's sort of illustrated by the difference between the claims raised in Kelo versus the claims raised in Nick. In Kelo, the party was essentially attempting to raise it, as the Attorney General mentioned, in a defensive posture, where you're saying this was not made a taking for public purpose, therefore the taking should not happen at all. The nature of that claim is that it really should be brought before the taking occurs. However, in Nick is a different situation. Nick is a claim for just compensation. And a claim for just compensation is really separate and independent from one where you're attempting to raise the takings claim defensively and block it. A claim for just compensation, Nick tells us, does not become ripe and cannot be raised until after the physical taking occurs. Or it could be a regulatory taking, but in either case, the claim for just compensation does not arise until the taking has actually occurred. That the latter claim, the one that is more like Nick, is the one that we are raising with compensation. And it is unfair to apply res judicata in that case to bar a claim for just compensation, where we had to have the first adjudication before the claim would even become ripe. And in no way does a claim for just compensation undermine, disturb, or change the nature of the administrative decision that caused the taking in the first place. Although, as Moore and Carroll illustrate, there are some cases where a constitutional claim could be raised defensively that could actually have been adjudicated in the prior appeal. This is not one of them, though. Additionally, I would like to address repeatedly it has been said that the statute allows, that the appeal statute is somehow broader and allows additional claims to be raised. That is not right. The legislature used the term issues. Additional issues may be raised. I assume that they understood the difference between issue and claim, just as collateral estoppel versus res judicata is issue versus claim preclusion. In this case, the appeals process offered no opportunity to raise a claim for just compensation, especially where we're not seeking to disturb the underlying adjudication. We're seeking the just compensation. I would like
counsel,
to
counsel on that last point. I thought historically that is when federal takings claims were raised.
You could have both, or you could raise one or the other. And so in Kelo, for instance, a homeowner was resisting the fact of the taking at all. And if they had prevailed that it was not taken for a public purpose, it could not be taken at all. But that is not mutually exclusive with a claim for just compensation. In fact, my client did want to keep the property, but in this litigation, she understands and accepts the validity of the underlying decision and does not seek to disturb it. And therefore, there was no independent adjudication. There's no independent appeal to join with the 1983 action. And as the court recognizes, the courts of common pleas, our courts of general jurisdiction in state, have concurrent jurisdiction over 1983 claims. They could be raised in federal or state claim. But to accept the defense position would, in fact, rob a plaintiff of the right to seek that relief in federal court, which Nick says that those constitutional violations demand a federal constitutional remedy. I see that my time has run up. I had one additional point to make, but I will rest if the.
Okay. No. We'll go ahead, but maybe if you can keep it brief. We have several other arguments, and we've devoted quite a bit of time to yours.
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate it. I just wanted to address abandonment very briefly. This statute, where it applies to vacant and abandoned properties, it does not correspond exactly with the plain English meaning nor the common law understanding of what abandonment meant. Abandonment in this statute can apply to properties that are simply not inhabited right now. And in this case,
I think we do understand that one. So okay. Thank you very much. Thank you to all four of you. This is a really tricky case. We're so grateful to have the amicus support. Thank you, Ms. Martin. Thank you, Mr. Hendershot, for your very helpful briefs and argument, answering our questions. It's not easy when the law changes in the middle of litigation, and that's what we have here. So really appreciate the briefs and the arguments, and the case will be submitted. Thank you.